to fly to California to get married. Cynthia vowed to get the money somehow. Louis wrote Cynthia almost every day, and every morning waited for the mailman to bring Cynthia's pink letters. Though their letters were adoring, they revealed how little the two knew each other. Cynthia had no idea how deeply Louis was haunted by his war ordeal, or that he was turning to alcohol to cope. In critical ways, she was engaged to a stranger. Cynthia vowed to help Louis forget the war, and he grasped her promise as a lifeline. "If you love me enough," he wrote back, "I'll have to forget it. How much can you love?" In May, Cynthia's parents agreed to let her visit Louis on the condition that they not marry until the fall. Cynthia raced to the airport. When her plane landed, Louis bounded up the steps to embrace her, then squared her home to meet his family. The Zamperinis fell for her, just as Louis had. Driving away, Louis sensed Cynthia drawing backward. Maybe she'd seen something that hinted at all she didn't know, or maybe impulsive decisions were becoming too real. Thinking she was slipping away from him, Louis lost his temper and said they should end the engagement. Cynthia panicked, and they argued. When they calmed down, they made a decision. A few days later, Louis and Cynthia drove to a church. One of Louis's friends walked Cynthia down the aisle, and the couple said their vows. That night, Cynthia called home with the news. She hung on the phone all evening, crying, while her mother bawled her out. Unable to get her to hang up, Louis picked up a bottle of champagne, drank it dry, and went to sleep alone. Chapter 35. Coming Undone. One evening in 1946, Louis sat in a dinner club with Cynthia nestled near him. Phil and Ceci were visiting, and Fred Garrett had joined them. Phil and Louis were grinning at each other. The last time they'd been together was in early 1944, when Phil was leaving Ofuna, and they didn't know if they'd live to see each other again. They were happy. Sporting a prosthetic leg, Fred bumped to the dance floor to prove he could still cut a rug. Phil and Ceci were moving to New Mexico, where Phil would open a plastics business. Louis and Cynthia were glowing from their honeymoon. As the men laughed and chatted, all they'd been through seemed forgotten. But then a waiter set a plate before Fred. On it, beside the entree, was white rice. That was all it took. Fred was suddenly raving, furious, shouting at the waiter. Louis tried to calm him, but Fred had come undone. The waiter hurried the rice away, and Fred pulled himself together, but the spell was broken. For these men, nothing was ever going to be the same. After World War II, former prisoners of the Japanese, known as Pacific POWs, came home. Physically, they were ravaged. The average Army or Army Air Forces POW had lost 61 pounds. They were severely malnourished, many were crippled, and nearly all were afflicted with serious diseases. Many would never fully recover. Some couldn't be saved. The emotional injuries were even worse. Mental illnesses were among the most common diagnoses given to former Pacific POWs, and they proved lasting. Some 40 years after the war, nearly 90% of former Pacific POWs in one study still suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, a devastating syndrome characterized in part by flashbacks, anxiety, and intense nightmares. Post-war life was often tormented. Men sleepwalked, acting out prison camp traumas, and woke screaming or lashing out. One had a recurrent hallucination of seeing his dead POW friends walking past. Another, a wealthy physician, fought urges to scavenge in trash cans. One man regularly woke running outside, shouting for help, and avoided hotels because his screaming nightmares upset other guests. 60 years after the war, he still hoarded clothes and food. Many men escaped by drinking. More than a quarter of former Pacific POWs became alcoholics. Seeing an Asian person or hearing Japanese left many men shaking, weeping, enraged, or lost in flashbacks. At one hospital just after the war, former POWs tried to attack a staffer who was of Japanese ancestry, not knowing he was an American veteran. The Pacific POWs who went home in 1945 were torn down men. Carrying unspeakable memories of torture and humiliation, they felt deeply vulnerable. Their dignity was gone, replaced with a sense of shame and worthlessness. The central struggle of post-war life was to restore their dignity. There was no one right way to peace. Every man had to find his own path. Some succeeded. For others, the war never ended. For some, years of rage, terror, and humiliation concentrated into an obsession with revenge. The honeymoon brought Louis a brief respite from his troubles. Sleeping beside Cynthia each night, he still saw the bird lurking in his dreams. But now the sergeant hung back. It was the closest thing to peace Louis had known since Green Hornet had hit the water. Louis and Cynthia rented an apartment in a cheap quarter of Hollywood. Louis's mother had been awarded his $10,000 life insurance payout when he was declared dead, and Louis was allowed to keep it. Investing it brought him a modest income, but the apartment was the best he could do. It was tiny, nothing like the mansion Cynthia had grown up in, but she did her best to make it homey. On his first night there, Louis fell into a dream. As always, the bird was there, but he was no longer hesitant. The sergeant towered over Louis, the belt flicking from his hand, lashing Louis's face. Every night he returned. Louis was helpless once again. Trying to cope with his nightmares and increasing anxiety, Louis began to feel an old pull. The Summer Olympics, suspended since 1936, were set to return. They'd be held in London in July 1948, 2 years away. Louis began taking long hikes, borrowing a dog for company. His bad leg felt sturdy, his body healthy. He began training. His strength returned, and his dodgy leg gave him no pain. He took it slowly, thinking always of London in 48. He began clocking miles in 4 minutes 18 seconds with ease. He was coming all the way back. But running wasn't the same. Once he'd felt liberated by it, but now it felt forced and joyless. With no other answer to his turmoil, Louis doubled his workouts, and his body answered. One day, Louis set off to see how fast he could turn 2 miles. He felt pain in his bad ankle, just where it had been injured, at Naoetsu. He shouldn't have kept pushing, but pushing was all he knew now. As he completed the 1st mile, his ankle was crackling with pain. On he went, running for London. Late in his last lap, there was an abrupt slicing sensation in his ankle. He half-hopped to the line and collapsed. He'd run the year's fastest 2 mile on the Pacific coast. But it didn't matter. A doctor confirmed he'd worsened his war injury disastrously. It was all over. Louis was wrecked. The quest that had saved him as a kid, that had sustained him through prison camp, was lost. The last barricade within him fell. By day he obsessed about the bird. In his nightmares, the sergeant lashed him. As the belt whipped him, Louis would grasp his attacker's throat and close his hands around it. No matter how hard he squeezed, the black eyes still danced at him. Louis regularly woke screaming and soaked in sweat. He was afraid to sleep. He began going to bars and drinking hard, trying to drown the war. He often drank so much he passed out, but he welcomed it. It saved him from having to go to bed and wait for his monster. Cynthia couldn't talk him into giving it up. He left her alone each night while he went out to lose the war. Rage consumed him. Once he harassed a man for walking slowly in front of his car, and the man spat at him. Louis jumped out, and as Cynthia screamed for him to stop, beat the man to the ground. When another man accidentally let a door swing into him, Louis chested up to him and provoked a scuffle that ended with Louis grinding the man's face in the dirt. His mind derailed. While sitting at a bar, he heard a sudden loud sound, perhaps a car backfiring. Instantly, he was on the floor, cringing as the bar fell silent and people stared. On another night, he was drinking, his mind drifting when someone yelled something while joking with friends. In Louis's mind, it was, "Kyrie!" He leapt to attention, heart pounding, awaiting the flying belt buckle. The illusion cleared, and he saw that, again, everyone was looking at him. He felt foolish and humiliated. One day, Louis was overcome by a strange feeling, and suddenly he was back in the war, not a memory, but the actual experience. The glaring and grating and stench and howl and terror of it. When he emerged, he was confused and frightened. It was his first flashback. After that, if he glimpsed blood or saw a tussle in a bar, everything would reassemble itself as prison camp. Sometimes he felt imaginary lice and fleas wiggling on his skin. He drank harder. And then he saw a newspaper story that riveted his attention. A former POW had walked into a store, spotted one of his captors, and had him arrested. Louis's fury crystallized. He saw himself finding the bird and overpowering him, strangling him slowly, making him feel all the pain, fear, and helplessness that Louis felt. His veins beat with an electric urgency. Louis had no idea where the bird was, but felt sure that if he could return to Japan, he could hunt him down. This would be his reply to the bird's effort to extinguish his dignity. "I am still a man." He saw no other way to save himself. Louis had found a quest to replace his lost Olympics. He was going to kill the bird. Chapter 36 The Body on the Mountain. In the first winter after the war, a police officer trudged through a remote village in Japan's Nagano Prefecture, knocking on doors. The hunt for Mutsuhiro Watanabe now involved every police force in Japan. In one prefecture alone, 9,100 officers participated. The officer reached the largest house in the village. Inside, he found an old farmer, his wife, and their laborer. As the laborer prepared pickles, a traditional gift to visitors, the officer showed a photograph of Watanabe. Did they recognize him? None of them did. The officer left. He had no idea that the fugitive he was seeking had just been standing in front of him, holding a plate of pickles. The bird had come to Nagano the previous September. He grew a mustache and chose an alias, Saburo Ota, a name unlikely to attract notice. He told people he was a refugee from Tokyo whose relatives were dead, a common story. He met the old farmer and offered himself as a laborer in exchange for room and board. The farmer agreed. At night, lying on the farmer's floor, Watanabe couldn't sleep. Thousands of other soldiers were being arrested and tried for war crimes. Many were given death sentences. On the pages on which he poured out his emotions, Watanabe wrote of feeling guilty when he thought of those soldiers. He pondered his behavior toward the POWs. "Am I guilty?" he wrote. He didn't answer his question, but expressed no remorse. listening to radio reports on fugitive war crime suspects, Watanabe watched his hosts, worried that they'd suspect him. The newspapers called the fugitives enemies of human beings, wounding Watanabe's feelings. It seemed to him outrageous that the Allies, who would not forgive, would oversee trials of Japanese. "I wanted to cry out," he wrote. "That's not fair." The tension wore on him. He had to work himself to exhaustion to bring sleep on. He wondered if he should surrender. One night, as the fire died in the hearth, Watanabe told the farmer who he was. The farmer listened, his eyes on the fire, his tongue clicking on his teeth. "People say to control your mouth, or it brings evil," the farmer said. "You should be careful of your speech." He said nothing else and turned away. Watanabe waited out a bitter winter. The policeman's visit shook him. The farmer's wife eyed him with what seemed to be suspicion. When night fell, Watanabe lay awake, mulling capture and execution. When summer came, Watanabe was asked to accompany the farmer's son as he toured the country selling leather. The tour would take them through major cities where he was surely being sought. But he was living on the farmer's good graces and had to accept. Watanabe donned glasses to obscure his features and headed off, filled with anxiety. In the cities, no one gave Watanabe a second look. As his fear of being caught eased, he became bolder. He longed to see his family. They would now be in Tokyo on their regular visit to his elder sister Michiko's home. Watanabe took out fortune-telling cards his little sister had given him just before he'd fled. The cards told him if he went to his family, he'd be safe. On a sweltering day in the summer of 1946, Utsuhiro boarded a train for Tokyo. His timing couldn't have been worse. Doubling their efforts to find him, the police were scouring the city for him. Watanabe was walking into the manhunt. The Watanabe family was sitting in Michiko's house when the front door opened and in walked Mutsuhiro. The room fell silent as the startled family members looked at Mutsuhiro and then at each other. Mutsuhiro, overwhelmed and dizzy from the heat, wavered, afraid he'd faint. The family broke into celebration. For 2 hours, Mutsuhiro listened to his family tell of being arrested, questioned, followed, and searched. He said nothing of where he'd been, believing they'd fare better if they didn't know. There was shuffling outside. Someone looked and saw detectives. The Watanabes sprang up. Someone tossed Mutsuhiro's belongings into a closet. Someone else whisked their teacups into the sink. Mutsuhiro raced into a tea room. Behind him, he heard the detectives enter and begin questioning his family. His heart racing, Mutsuhiro tried to decide whether to run or conceal himself here. The room was tiny, but there was a closet. Slowly, slowly, he opened the closet door and squeezed in. He decided not to close the door as it risked making noise. He stood there, a hand over his mouth, to smother the sound of his breath. The tea room door opened. A detective looked in, and there was a pause as he looked about. If he only turned his eyes to the closet, he'd see Mutsuhiro. "It is tidy," he said. The door closed. The detectives left. Mutsuhiro had planned to stay overnight, but the scare changed his mind. He told his mother he'd try to see her again in 2 years. Then he left. Walking back, he wrote, "Into the lonesome world." Watanabe returned to the village and waited tables in the farmer's son's coffee shop. The farmer approached him with a proposition. Arranged marriage was still common in Japan, and the farmer had found a young woman for him. Watanabe was tempted. He was lonely and unhappy, and liked the idea of marrying. but marriage now seemed impossible. He said no. The woman eventually came to him. When the farmer's son fell ill, she visited, and Watanabe went in to meet her. He liked her. Part of him seemed to want to fall for her, and he believed that love could